Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
For Tuesday, August 21st, 2018, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out what recent policy changes by the Trump administration mean for undocumented immigrants in the Valley who have been victims of crime. We'll also go to the foothills and find out why some of the world's top African drummers recently made the trip to the Fresno County Mountains. And we'll find out why one prominent outdoor magazine is sounding the alarm over recent rescues on Mount Whitney, saying that selfie-induced summit fever is contributing to dangerous conditions on the highest peak in the lower 48. We begin, though, with a new series launching this week on our program. Over the course of just 3 months in 2017, over 2,000 incidents of workplace violence in healthcare were reported in California. Some experts would say that number is probably low because they suspect the issue is actually underreported for a variety of reasons. One of the leading ones is a perception that tolerating violence is just part of the job. In collaboration with USC's Center for Health Journalism, FM 89's Laura Tsutsui reports this is a perspective many in California hope to change.
6 months ago, Jennifer Bailey worked at an assisted living memory care facility in Fresno. One evening, she was helping a patient get ready for bed.
I was walking toward the door to leave after I got the resident I was assisting in bed, and she, for lack of a better term, came unhinged.
She says the job was similar to being a certified nursing assistant, and she would help residents with day-to-day things. That evening, Bailey was walking out with a bag of dirty laundry, and she says the resident's roommate grabbed the bag, thinking that Bailey was stealing her clothes.
Once the bag broke, she started grabbing more at me, and it felt like it was going on for hours. I was probably there for 25 seconds.
She says it only stopped when the resident Bailey was helping get to bed tried to intervene.
She got up and she's like, "Don't hit her," and starts coming toward her. And when she turned to face the woman who was getting out of bed to come to my rescue, I was able to get my walkie, run in between them to protect themselves from each other. And that's when I was able to scream I needed help immediately. The nurse came in and, you know, it was diffused at that second. But I was beyond hysterical, and my arms were red because I had scratches from my elbow down to my wrist on both arms.
The resident who attacked Bailey was actually moving to a new facility within the week, so Bailey knew that she wouldn't have another encounter with that resident, but the stress and anxiety stuck with her.
For a lot of ways, I kind of felt, well, if I can't do this, you know, they're going to look at it like, you can't do your job, and they'll find somebody else who can.
Bailey hadn't experienced violence on the job before then, but at the time, she was also feeling burnt out. Beyond telling her supervisor, she didn't feel like she had a lot of options to help herself recover. After the attack, Bailey decided to quit.
It was kind of the figurative straw.
Bailey thought if she wanted to stay in that job, she might just have to accept this. Among healthcare workers, she isn't alone in thinking that. Dr. Susan Goodwin-Gerbrick is a professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Minnesota. She came out with one of the first comprehensive studies about violence against nurses back in 2004.
We certainly found very high rates for those that work in nursing homes and long-term care facilities, also the emergency and psychiatric departments.
Gerbrick says that violence can come as both physical and non-physical force against someone. Healthcare workers who reached out to us say they've been threatened, had things thrown at them, and were even punched or kicked when trying to give someone care. Gerbrick's study surveyed over 6,000 nurses in Minnesota and came up with several risk factors. A majority of assaults were from patients. Gerbrick also found that while over half of the assaults were reported, either in writing or orally, many who didn't report said it was because they felt like tolerating violence was part of the job.
It's not just the nurses, but, technically all healthcare personnel are at potential risk.
Gerbrick noted that there is legislation moving through Congress to curb the issue. In March, California Representative Ro Khanna introduced the Healthcare Workplace Violence Prevention Act. At the same time, some states have taken it upon themselves to implement healthcare violence prevention rules. California is one of them, and that's in part due to the California Nurses Association, a state chapter for National Nurses United.
The federal bill is very similar to the California bill. It's a good template. It's successfully passed.
Gerard Brogan is a registered nurse and a lead representative with the association. The California bill to prevent healthcare workplace violence passed in 2014. It required hospitals to develop a workplace violence prevention plan. The plan had to include things like annual employee training and a system for reporting incidents to the state.
Looking at the research, we came to the conclusion that hospitals are loath to report incidents of violence to the state, or anyone for that matter, or collect them themselves.
Hospitals were supposed to have implemented those new regulations as of April of this year, or risk being out of compliance with California's Division of Occupational Safety and Health. It's too early to tell if the new regulation has actually reduced violence. Brogan says that as far as he knows, hospitals have been slow to comply. He also says it's going to take a cultural shift to get nurses and other healthcare employees not to tolerate violence or actions that could escalate.
It's always been seen, the culture really, is that it's part of the job. You're here to be a nurse. You're here to self-sacrifice. You've got to suck up patients' complaints, patients' anger, to the point of both verbal and physical abuse.
Local hospitals I spoke with said that they've had safety training and procedures in place long before the new Cal-OSHA regulations. The biggest change, they say, has been the centralized reporting to the state, which they say they've adopted. Jennifer Bailey says she doesn't think her incident was reported outside of the facility because she didn't open a workers' compensation case. On top of that, assisted living facilities aren't included in the new law because the state doesn't classify them as health facilities. But she wishes she had known something like that might happen. She says the training she got didn't cover violence.
No one really says they can lose themselves in a moment. They can get agitated to the point of not realizing how far they've taken it. You know, they just, all they know is they want something or they need something or they're unhappy or they're stressed out or in pain. And a lot of times they can't communicate that.
Bailey says she's moved on, but she still thinks about her old job.
It still makes me sad because I know someone who's coming into the field, they might have the same situation I do. And something has to change. Something needs to be provided.
The catch is knowing what that something should be. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
Since President Donald Trump took office, immigration policies have been changing rapidly. Avenues that helped undocumented immigrants receive some form of legal status, like DACA, have been threatened. But there's another program that local immigration attorneys also have concerns about. The program was designed to help law enforcement officials catch criminals and can be a pathway to citizenship for immigrants. As Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez reports, federal policy changes and the presence of ICE agents at local courthouses could change the playing field.
About 8 years ago, Mirza Urayas was working at a restaurant in Bakersfield. She was the only person working up front and says it was business as usual until one man entered. He pointed a gun at me and said I had to give him money. I gave him money and he went running out of the store and threatened me before that. He said if I didn't give him the money, he would shoot me. She says she was the only witness to the robbery and law enforcement was depending on her to identify him. Urias called the situation traumatic. She even sought out help. I had to find a psychologist to help me a little. Yes, it did traumatize me a bit, but it's an experience that's not easy to deal with the first few days and while continuing to work. Another person would have quit, but since I needed the job, I needed to stay and keep moving forward, you know? Now, Uriah says she's doing better. I caught up with her at her home in Bakersfield this week. She's folding laundry in her living room while her two-year-old plays with her toys and watches the Pixar film Coco. Her three children were all born in the United States, unlike her. Urias was born in Mexico and has been living in the U.S. undocumented. She says if she does get deported, she has a plan to make sure her kids are cared for in the valley. But she has hope it won't ever come to that, because she's in the process of getting legal residency through a program for victims of crimes. The U non-immigrant visa, more widely known as a U visa, is a visa offered for undocumented immigrants who have been victims of violent crimes. The visa gives victims protection from deportation and a pathway to citizenship, as long as they meet certain requirements and cooperate with law enforcement. Because Urias was the only witness to the robbery, law enforcement depended on her to testify in court. I had to give testimony to the police and help them so they can identify the person who robbed me and also go to court to give testimony. But lately, there have been concerns about how the program is changing. For instance, local immigration attorney Jeremy Clayson says there have been some changes during the filing process for green cards since President Trump took office. Right now, when someone gets approved for a U visa, their past crimes are pardoned. After 3 years of having a U visa, recipients can apply for a green card. But now, Clayson says during this step in the process, there have been adjustments that raise concerns.
If a waiver was granted, if you were given your waiver or your pardon under the U visa, those past crimes from X amount of years ago that were already forgiven you, they should not thereafter provide a basis for them denying your green card. But we've seen through experience that that's what's happening under the Trump administration. Really frustrating.
Clayson says under the Obama administration, that didn't happen. They would not go back to reevaluate the crimes that happened before the U visa status was applied. Clayson says the Trump administration is reexamining past crimes. Now he says he has different conversations with his clients when it's time for them to apply for residency.
And what I'm telling them now during the consultation now is, hey, it's green card time, but they're going to relitigate. They're going to re-examine all your past conduct, even though it was quote unquote already forgiven.
Clayson says that's happened in almost every green card application he's filed for U visa recipients under the current administration. As a result, he says more U visas will get denied. Clayson says his office hasn't seen any denials yet, but they're concerned.
The fact they're asking for me to prove to them why it's so important that this person continue to remain here, and they didn't ask for that same evidence back several years ago when they gave them the U visa, that in and of itself is an indication that they will probably increasingly be denying green card applications.
Clayson says the government should give victims permanent residency because of their willingness to cooperate with law enforcement. But he says it seems like the new administration is trying to find any way to deny green cards.
U visas are the most vulnerable members of our society, right? These are the folks that have been, right? They've been victims of violent crimes in the U.S., and it has to be a violent crime. And those are people who actually helped in the prosecution and or investigation of that crime against the perpetrator.
This change isn't the only concern Clayson has when it comes to U visas. The recent ICE arrests at the Fresno courthouse are a concern to Clayson, especially since some of his U visa clients have to testify at the courthouse if subpoenaed. He says he has had clients that have been deported while waiting for their U visas to be approved.
I have had clients, several clients, who were deported from the U.S. while their U visas were pending and or while they were scheduled to testify against the perpetrators in their criminal cases.
Clayson says that's probably going to happen more often since President Trump issued a memo last year that changed some guidelines regarding deportations the last administration put in place. Under the Obama administration, people who had U visas pending weren't at risk of getting deported. But that's not the case anymore.
That U visa memo back from the Obama administration was replaced by this other cryptic memo that says, I don't care if you have a U visa or not, right? If it's not in the public interest, we're going to deport you even during the pendency of your U visa.
That February 2017 memo reversed an Obama-era policy that prioritized deportations of undocumented immigrants with criminal convictions. Other local immigration attorneys have concerns about ICE's presence at the courthouse, too.
So if a victim is afraid to go to the courthouse to give testimony because of ICE being picked up or having problems with immigration, then that prevents them from getting the initial U visa of support to law enforcement and cooperation to prosecute the perpetrator of the crime, as well as getting the certification the second time around for the residency process.
Olga Grosh is an immigration attorney in Fresno at Pacifica Immigration Law Group. She says ICE showing up at the courthouse in plain clothes and making arrests is causing fear. And that fear could be the factor if a victim doesn't show up to testify. Even though there have been no reports of victims being picked up by ICE locally, she says news reports of it happening around the country are enough to scare some of her clients. Grosh says this goes against the whole point of the U visa.
When victims of crime are being picked up by ICE, that is counterproductive to the entire process of the U visa. That a victim should not be afraid of the police, that a victim should not be afraid of immigration just because they are a victim of a crime.
ICE did not respond to a request for comment from Valley Public Radio. Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims says victims shouldn't be scared to report crimes, especially since there have been no reports of victims being arrested at the Fresno courthouse, just suspects of crimes.
Here in Fresno, they arrest people who are suspects and have committed crimes, not people that are in the courthouse to testify as a victim or a witness.
Mim says U visa recipients shouldn't be fearful of testifying at the courthouse, and undocumented immigrants shouldn't hesitate to report crimes.
I think those that are raising the concern, unfortunately, are scaring the public more than they need to be. I mean, the message is if you are a victim or a witness of crime and you get a U visa, you have some protection.
Back in Bakersfield, Uraya says she can soon apply for a green card. She doesn't think it's going to be an easy or short process, but says she's patient. She says even if U visas didn't exist, she would still be willing to cooperate with law enforcement. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Two Sundays ago, the community of Stratford lost its water supply. It might be shocking to turn on the tap and have nothing come out, but it's actually not an uncommon issue in the San Joaquin Valley. That and water quality, as we've reported here on Valley Public Radio. So what's it like living without running water, and what's the status of getting this unincorporated community in Kings County back online? Joining us now is Martin Chavez of the Stratford Public Utilities District Board. Martin, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
First of all, let's go back to how this all began over a week ago now. What was the beginning of this problem for you?
So the beginning of this problem goes back to Friday of last week. So our main well, which is located on our main street, well number 5, started having mechanical issues, so it went down. And then we had to rely on our backup well, which is located right behind the main office of our board. And that well just went down Sunday morning. So by the time I got up Sunday morning getting ready to go to work, there was no water coming out of the faucets when I went to go brush my teeth. So I had to go and rush over to the gym, which by the local gym, I mean 15 miles away, which is located in Hanford. Shower up, head to work, and then later on realized that we had literally ran out of water in the sense that both of our pumps were out and we don't have any other pumps besides those two.
Is that how you found out about it when you were brushing your teeth?
Yes. So that's how I found out about it. I'm like, Mom, is the boiler off? Or, you know, you tend to think about those things. You know, you always see on TV, people are fearful about turning on the faucet and realizing there's no more water. And then you come to realize that can happen to you at home. And that's what I realized Sunday, that we have issues here in the valley that need to be addressed, such as water. You know, we need to have reliable and safe water for drinking.
Yeah, and this is a problem that communities have faced, whether it's mechanical failures like you experienced in Stratford or in East Porterville where wells went dry. Yeah. And that's something that's happened across the valley, not just in East Porterville, but probably the most significant case of that there. Was it entirely a mechanical problem, or was it also compounded by the drought and by a declining aquifer?
Yes, so that's one thing that's definitely, it was mainly a mechanical issue in the sense that the pump, just our main well, just had too much stress on it. It was a hot day and it started up taking up sand, and that pretty much made it clogged the pump to the point where it was not working. So the pump is okay. We were able to place it back on, and now it's delivering water for people to bathe and bathe and flush toilets. But like you said, this is something that's happening because of the drought. Subsidence is a real thing. Back in 2014, NBC Nightline actually did an interview there in Stratford and talked about how our ground is sinking. And that's something that's happening, that it's affecting the pumps and it's affecting the soil quality, it's affecting the water quality. So that's something the state really needs to start focusing on, investing in, making sure that we start fixing our subsidence, we start getting more storage for communities to not have to rely on solely pumping water. Because once you run dry and there's no surface water, then you're in a big issue, like East Porterville has found out and other communities in the valley.
What was the response like from the community, both your customers and the valley community at large?
It was just an overwhelming, great support response. Our local farmers truly stepped up on that day. We often talk about like farmers being there for the community, and you saw it. They were the first ones to respond. They were the ones that got the pump crews out there, fixed the pump that the state had told us was non-functionable 3 years ago, and they're the ones that got it up and running. So our residents were able to bathe, and they were able to flush toilets, and our students were able to have water to flush toilets when they went back to school on Wednesday. Along with that, our local businesses, Tachi Palace, donated pallets of water. They were the first ones that started donating water. Keens Lions Club, our elected officials, such as Assemblymember Rudy Salas, State Senator Andy Vidak, they got Pepsi-Cola to donate a semi full of trucks and Nestle water as well. And even our Congressman David Valadeo was able to talk to U.S. Secretary Perdue about this issue when he was in town. So that was great. You know, like a cabinet member knew what was going on in the small community of Stratford. So appreciated that everyone came together. Now it's a matter of our state government actually doing something about it, and not just, hey, this is an issue. It's now we got to make sure we invest to make a new well, Joe. It's pretty expensive. It costs us over $1 million, and a community like Stratford can't afford $1 million, especially with the interest the state is giving us. So the Water Resource Board, when they talk about them grabbing, you saw the rally yesterday in Sacramento, them doing the water grab, those things are real, you know, like our valley communities are being neglected, especially when it comes to water.
Yeah, and Martin Chavez, they're referring to the state's proposed changes to the Bay Delta Plan that would increase the amount of water that flows in natural flow and valley rivers, increasing that up to about 40% of what it would be naturally. And the ones who would be losing out would be cities and valley farmers, largely. Talking about Stratford and the community there, has this been a concern for a while? Is this one of those things you've been worried might happen at some point, that you know, with aging wells, aging equipment, and as you talked about the sinking of the land with subsidence, has this been a kind of a concern in the background that, wow, we at some point something really bad could happen and we could be out of water for a while?
Yeah, this is a concern we've had for many years now. It goes back to like 5-6 years, especially I've been on the board for 2 years now, and this is definitely a concern we have at every meeting. Is like, we have one pump and one backup pump, like one main pump and one backup. Like, that's not enough leeway for error. You know, one goes down, the other one, it's not 100% to be functioning full time, the backup one. So that's a huge concern we've had. I mean, the process of building a new well has gone back 5+ years, and pretty much it's just back and forth with the state. The state tells us you can build a well now, but we're going to charge you this interest rate, which the community can't afford. So now it's really a matter of the state having to step up and pretty much fix some of these issues. You saw Prop 1, for example. There's funds there that didn't end up going to Valley communities, didn't even end up going to storage. You saw Temperance Flat that would have helped out the Valley pretty much get shoved to the side, which that would have been beneficial to my community and our local farmers and many of the Valley communities.
There's a proposal in Sacramento right now, a bill that would create what's being called a water tax by some. Others call it a way to fund clean and safe and affordable drinking water in communities like yours. Mm-hmm. That has since been amended a little bit, and now it's becoming, I guess, a voluntary tax. We'll see how it plays through Sacramento if it winds up getting the governor's signature as it makes its way through the legislature. Is your group optimistic that there's going to be funding from Sacramento to solve these problems?
Well, that's one thing. You got to always be optimistic. But when it comes to Sacramento, it's one of those things is that we so often pass this new bond, this new tax, and the funds just don't get sent to where they're meant to go, especially the communities that truly need it and are in dire need of those funds. So it's one of those things, we continue seeing these taxes and these bonds, like there's money in the state budget to fix these issues. It's just a matter of the state actually doing something about it rather than deterring the money to something else.
So tell me a little more about your district. You provide water. You also do what else, and how many customers do you have?
Yeah, so we provide water and we do sewer for approximately, it depends throughout the year, it's between 330 households to 350 households. So it's a small community of roughly 1,100, 200 people. And that's one of the things for, like, when we were building this new well, the state came back to us and said, we can't afford a 0% interest. We can't have a 0% interest rate because our community's increasing in population, which studies have shown our community's actually decreasing the last 10 years in population. So that's one of the things that we're struggling with right now with the state. On top of that, it's just acquiring land. So if you know anyone that has land in Stratford, please let them know. Our district would truly benefit from that, or if there's any listeners on that right now.
So what's the status? The water is back running through taps, but it's not yet safe to drink. When do you expect that to change?
We expect that to change pretty soon. I wouldn't be able to give you an exact deadline. That's something our Granger, which is our contractor, is dealing with right now with the Division of Water in the county. And that's just something of us having to put in chlorine and all that stuff to flush out the system from the sand and make sure it's back up and running. Because when the water went down, one of the local farmers stepped up and connected their well to our system for people to bathe and flush toilets. But as you know, ag water is not to the same standards as municipal water. So that's one of the things we have to make sure we clean out the system before the notice is lifted. So we probably see a few more days until we're back to normal.
We certainly wish you and all the residents of Stratford the best. As residents there, over a week without drinking water running through their taps after two wells in the community failed. We've been talking with Martin Chavez of the Stratford Public Utilities District Board today on Valley Edition. Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The San Joaquin Valley is a melting pot. It's home to diaspora from dozens of countries, and we celebrate that diversity with traditional festivals and performances throughout the year. One celebration you may not have heard of, however, is a summer camp in the Sierra foothills that teaches some traditional arts from West Africa. Valley Public Radio's Kerry Klein reports from Dunlap, east of Fresno, near the entrance of Kings Canyon National Park.
Some people escape into the Sierra Nevada for serenity and silence. But every August, a few hundred campers flock to the Fresno County foothills for the freedom to be loud.
This is Camp Ferretta, an intensive multi-day festival dedicated to teaching West African drumming and dancing. Every corner of this camp is awash in the sounds of traditional drums, dancing feet adorned with bells, and an instrument like a marimba called a balafone. This festival attracts dancers, drummers, and artisans of all ages and ethnicities from all over the world, including Credence Love, an entrepreneur and dancer from Baltimore.
Ferretta is one of my favorite camps.
She's come to the camp for 3 years. She says it's the highlight of her summer.
You're actually staying, you're eating, we're doing performance together, we have talent shows, we have, you know, fires, we're getting together and doing storytelling, we have people singing songs.
The camp's classrooms and cabins radiate outward from a central cafeteria in a small shaded square. There, people chat or practice alongside tables piled high with drums, jewelry, and bright wax print fabrics for sale.
It's kind of like our African village, and we have different teachers that come from different places, like the Congo and from Guinea and Senegal and different places.
West Africa is well represented at Ferretta. Most of the camp's instructors were born there, and that traditional village feeling is intentional. The word Ferretta itself means city of dance in Susu, one of the languages spoken in Guinea. That's the home of Yusuf Kumbasa, one of the camp's directors and founders.
Yeah, it's like back home. Yeah, you and the villas, everybody come in and enjoy together dancing.
This multicultural village gathers in Dunlap every August for 8 days, packed with drumming and dancing, learning and sharing. And though the music may initially call people to the camp, what keeps them coming back is the community.
It's really a feeling that we feel like this is the place that, you know, where we can stay together, share our stories and inspire each other.
Bongo Sidibe is a drum teacher at Ferretta, living in San Francisco. He specializes in a few traditional instruments, including the djembe, a drum that looks like a giant wine goblet. He explains how he teaches the djembe to beginner students.
I would teach them the basic stuff if they never learned before in their life, how to get the don, slap, bass. Don, slap, bass.
Those three pitches form the rhythms and melodies that have been hugely influential in music around the world.
We hear a lot of jazzes and funkies, gospel music, all these things, you know, like they all got their root came from those music, West African traditional music.
That richness came at a terrible price, the slave trade. When citizens from Ghana, Senegal, and other West African countries were sold around the world, the traditional music they brought was absorbed into their new home countries. Hanif Riley is a drummer and artisan in Los Angeles. He says his precise lineage was lost when his ancestors were sold to slaveholders in North America. But playing this music helps him honor his history.
We lost language, we lost the traditions, we lost knowing who we are and where we're from. So that's been a big draw to me to this drum because it helps me to be connected to those things.
Healing is a common thread at Camp Ferretta. A nurse from Oakland tells me Ferretta helped her recover from a traumatic car accident a few years ago. For Mamadi Kuruma, a master drummer from Guinea who now lives in Three Rivers, playing music reminds him of his late father. He speaks mostly French. He says he doesn't want to lose his father's culture, and he wants to share it with the world. He teaches in Boston and Guinea, but he doesn't have many students from the San Joaquin Valley. Not many Valley residents come to Camp Ferretta either, something director Christina Tuchillo would like to change. Still, she's thrilled to see attendees alongside one another from all over the U.S., Mexico, and Australia. She was inspired by a moment a few days earlier when drummers from 6 countries, black and white, substituted for a dance class when not enough musicians showed up.
It just made me smile so much. Like, these people came together to make it happen, even though we didn't have all the official drummers. And the people dancing were just, you know, beaming.
It's easy to think that something magical about the Sierra foothills is what helps bring Camp Ferretta together. But drum teacher Bongo Sidibe says, no way. It's the people, their energy, and their culture.
We bring the party.
The camp officially ended Monday. Now the party will have to wait until next August. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Mount Whitney is the highest peak in the lower 48 states. It's also a draw for hikers and climbers from across the world. However, inexperienced hikers and a culture of summit fever are making the mountain what some call an overcrowded catastrophe. Joining us now to talk about that issue is journalist Megan Michelson, who wrote about the issue for the online edition of Outside Magazine, outsideonline.com. She joins us today on Skype. Megan, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
So you had a personal hiking experience on Mount Whitney recently that was rather remarkable. Let's talk about that trip and how it played out. Well, what did you see and how did the hike begin?
Yeah, I found out later it actually wasn't that remarkable of an experience. Other people are experiencing a lot of the same sort of accidents and injuries on Mount Whitney that I saw. But it was early June, and I set out to try to get to the summit of Mount Whitney with my brother-in-law. It was a Sunday, and there was still snow on the upper portion of the mountain, which we had researched and were aware of. So we brought the proper equipment for that type of winter mountaineering travel. So that's crampons, which are spikes that you put onto the bottom of your hiking boots to help get you more traction on snow. And then an ice axe to help with self-arresting if you were to fall on snow, and then a helmet just for safekeeping. So we got to the about 6 miles in to what's called the chute, which is the snow-covered portion of the upper part of the trail, a few hours after leaving the trailhead around 3 a.m. And we ended up with a few people falling down the snow-covered chute, several hundred feet toppling into rocks that were coming out from the bottom of the chute. And one person was severely injured and unconscious with a head injury, and another woman had a very badly broken arm. And so we ended up assisting with the rescue a little bit and then leaving to go try to call for help, because the woman with the head injury we knew was going to need a helicopter evacuation. So we headed down the mountain, and many people spent hours and hours that day helping to rescue those two very injured people and get them off the mountain safely.
Did you have any idea that you would encounter an experience like that?
Anytime you head to high elevations, and I've spent a fair amount of time in backcountry skiing and climbing big peaks, you always know there's a risk for this type of thing to happen, and you try to come prepared and hope for the best. So I certainly wasn't expecting it, but it's always a possibility.
And you said you did this hike in June. June in the rest of California is, you know, largely a warm time of year, and people are enjoying the start of summer. But June on Mount Whitney is a different place. Why did you decide to hike at that time?
Well, you have to apply for a permit in March. This is how the Forest Service sort of regulates the number of people who are climbing Mount Whitney. And it's a good thing they do, because otherwise it might be more crowded than it already is. But I had put down a bunch of dates, and I ended up getting a permit through a very tricky lottery system. Only about a third of people who want a permit get one. And that was just the date that I was allotted. So, and also I'm comfortable traveling on snow. So I was totally fine going when there was still snow. But I think a lot of people completely don't understand that in the late spring and early summer months, it's not just a long hike to the top of Mount Whitney. There is some snow travel that requires mountaineering equipment and some experience.
Your experience was not unique. There are many instances of similar accidents and people getting into trouble on Mount Whitney that are becoming more and more the norm. Tell me a little more about that.
Right. So after we saw that fall, I was heading home later that day, and I just started thinking, you know, was this just a one-off thing? And did we have really bad luck? Or is this happening all the time? Because people are showing up, they didn't have the right mountaineering equipment. A lot of them didn't seem like they had any experience using any of it. People are suffering from dehydration, hypothermia, altitude sickness. So I started making some calls. I called the Forest Service. I called the local search and rescue organization through the sheriff's department. And it turns out there's definitely more injuries that are happening on Mount Whitney. More people are applying for permits to climb Mount Whitney. And a lot of folks, just based on anecdotal information I heard from local guides and people who've spent a lot of time on Mount Whitney on both the more technical routes and the Mount Whitney Trail, which I was hiking, talked about seeing people of varying ability levels and with varying levels of equipment preparation attempting to push their way to the summit one guy I spoke with who's been up Whitney 7 times said that he's seen people miles from the top pushing forward without any water and just so determined to reach the summit that they're neglecting the fact that, you know, they're going to need to hydrate for the last few miles of the hike. And this is when they're really putting themselves and rescue personnel at risk.
You write in your article talking about the challenges of traversing an icy path up the mountain and seeing other people that were attempting to do this. You write, it felt as if everyone had raided an REI and landed here posing as mountaineers. Tell me a little more about that. How experienced should people be to begin to attempt something like Mount Whitney early in the summer when it's icy? Is this a real concern that people aren't ready for something as challenging as this?
Right. And I don't mean to deter people from spending time outside or having big objectives like high peaks. So I certainly didn't write this story with an attempt to make mountaineering or hiking, you know, an elitist thing that only the very best people should be doing. I think we do need more people into the getting into the outdoors. So I don't mean to discourage folks from trying these things, but I do think it's super important to start on lower elevation peaks, train properly, take mountaineering courses, hire a guide or go with a mentor, make sure you research everything about the conditions before you go. And then obviously on the trail, you need to take in the circumstances and always be willing to turn around if things aren't going the way that you had hoped. And yeah, I mean, there was just a varying level of preparation that I saw out there. And a lot of people, like I said, had, you know, they'd rented crampons that week, but they never used them before. They had driven up the night before with no sense of acclimatizing to higher elevations. And that can lead to altitude sickness. So there's certainly some steps that you should take before attempting the highest peak in the lower 48. And that's what a lot of the people I spoke with for the story for Outside told me, that this shouldn't be the first long hike that you do. This should be something that you work up toward. And sure, in later in the summer when there's no snow on the trail, it's about a 22-mile round trip hike on dirt and rock, and it can be completed by people with minimal mountaineering experience. But if you're going to go in the late spring or early summer when there's still snow on the trail, then you better be ready to cross snow safely.
And then there's the issue of overcrowding. That played into the experience that you saw to some degree with people losing their footing and tumbling down the slope. But overall, Mount Whitney has, you know, a lot of people are trying to summit this mountain. It's relatively accessible in the most populous state here in California. Tell me a little more about the concerns there with overcrowding overall on the mountain.
Right. Well, like I said, there is a permitting system, so they do try to regulate. Some people go without a permit and just hope that they don't get caught. And I think one of the main issues is that Whitney is so accessible. It's 3 hours from Los Angeles. It's, you know, there's a lot of urban areas within a very short drive away. So people are treating it like just a weekend getaway, which I would argue that it should be a longer term investment. You should take a few days off, go and adjust your body to the altitude before even setting out on the hike, maybe do a couple of shorter hikes before the big day. It's not just a, you know, 1 or 2 night getaway. And then in terms of the overcrowding on the mountain, a lot of people I spoke with also talked about issues of trash left on the mountain. People are leaving camping gear and other trash along the trail. And it's just the trail is definitely seeing the impact of a lot of people.
With the permitting system that's out there right now, obviously there's a limit to how many people this physically are safe to put up on the mountain and have going up the trail. Does that in some way contribute to that issue of summit fever?
Absolutely. And the Forest Service talked to me about that. So they said about 33% of people who want a Whitney permit actually get one through their lottery system. And that's 100 people per day for day hikes and 60 people for overnight backpacking trips. So it's really not very many people. So if you get a permit, the ranger said, people have this committed attitude about reaching the summit because they've put in the time and been lucky enough to score the permit. So that gives them this sense of, this is my one day to do it and I've got to do it no matter what. But we just have to remember that the mountain is always going to be there and we'll be able to get a permit again another year. And you just have to be willing to turn back when conditions present themselves that way.
And then there's the impact of resources that are expended when there is an accident. And certainly no one advocates that there shouldn't be an emergency response. But as you quote someone in your story, Bill Kirk, who's summited Whitney several times, there's no plan B up on the mountain. Tell me about that.
Right. I mean, I talk a little bit in my story about how social media is creating this frenzy to reach the summit. But obviously, summit fever has been around long before Instagram. And it's just this predetermined mission that people have when they set out on a climb like this, that they are going to get to the top no matter what. And that's just a really unsafe mindset to have, because it doesn't open you up to the possibility of weather changes, or the fact that you're not feeling well, or that you slipped and hurt your knee, or that you didn't pack enough food or water, and a variety of other issues that can arise. So I just think we need to work on our mindset when we're out in the mountains, in terms of being willing to turn around when things aren't going as planned, and know that it's still a successful day in the mountains if you got out there and enjoyed the beautiful wilderness setting that is the Eastern Sierra Nevada, and you don't have to stand on the summit to make it a successful day out there.
So will you be headed back to Mount Whitney?
That's a good question. I have really always wanted to summit that peak. And I obviously didn't make it up that day in June, earlier this summer. But after my experience there, I kind of have a feeling of just maybe going to some lesser known lower elevation peaks, maybe some 13,000 foot peaks around Mount Whitney that don't have a bunch of people on them. So I don't have any plans at this point to go back to Whitney.
Journalist Megan Michelson has a new piece in the online edition of Outside. It's called Whitney Has Turned Into an Overcrowded Catastrophe, talking about the challenges with rescues, people who are not necessarily prepared to summit the highest peak in the lower 48 states, and the issue of summit fever. You can find Megan's piece online at outsideonline.com, and she joined us today on Skype. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
It's back to school time, and that means the Valley's arts organizations are getting into full swing. It also means the local chapter of the League of Women Voters is celebrating Women's Equality Day. And this year, both of those things are related, as the League is honoring Fresno Philharmonic conductor Ray Hotoda at its annual event next Monday. And she's here with us right now to talk about the upcoming season of the orchestra. Their new masterwork season features some exceptional performances. Ray, welcome.
Thank you so much, Joe.
I want to get to the new season in just a second, but let's first talk about the award from the League of Women Voters for Women's Equality Day. How significant is that for you? That has to be a great honor.
I am so honored to be chosen. And really, to join these wonderful honorees as well, I just feel so lucky to be a part of this Fresno community and to be honored in this way.
And this is something that is a great honor for Fresno in a way also, because Fresno is so fortunate to have you as conductor of the orchestra. There are relatively few women in those positions across major American orchestras. Do you see that changing in the future?
I do. And I hope it continues to grow. I think the more people are seeing women on the podium, I think the more chances and opportunities women will receive.
Now you have the new season of the Philharmonic, the 2018-2019 season. Hard to believe we're already talking about 2019, but it's right around the corner. And this is the first season, unlike last year, which had kind of already been in the works before your selection. This is the first time, as I understand it, you were able to put your entire stamp on the selections the orchestra will be performing. Tell me about what that experience was like.
Well, first of all, I want to thank all of your listeners and all of the patrons of the Fresno Philharmonic for a fantastic inaugural year last season of the 17-18 season. I felt so welcomed into the community, and I just want to send a great big shout out to everyone who came to our concerts, but not only that, stayed after for the Stay Tuned series that we started. And it was just such a great, enthusiastic welcome into my first season last year. So to continue with that tradition, I am really looking forward to kind of getting to know more of the community and And to really, this season, the 18-19 season, I think really reflects a little bit more of who we are, you know, who we are in Fresno, in this community. And so to make a deeper connection in the community and to explore the unique power of music, each concert really tells a story. And so this is how we're programming this 18-19 season with, music that features poetry to music that reflects the community. We're doing a world premiere commission this year in April, and commissioning a fantastic composer, Danuk Wijerotny, who is writing a piece for us, for the Fresno Philharmonic, that really reflects this community. And he's going to be doing a kind of a residency, getting to know the different organizations and getting to know the people of Fresno this fall. So that's really exciting. But to really encapsulate the season, well, we are doing four American composers. We're doing four living composers, in addition to playing wonderful traditional music of the orchestral repertoire, like Tchaikovsky's First Piano Concerto with John Nakamatsu, our wonderful soloist that opens the season, to featuring a woman composer in January, Missy Mazzoli, who is now the resident composer of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. So we're thrilled to present one of her pieces, and a Fresno composer, a local composer, Benjamin Boone, who is, we are doing his Waterless Music, which actually is featuring poetry by the poet laureate Philip Levine.
It has to be a lot of
fun. Lots on the plate this season.
It has to be a lot of fun to plan everything out. I imagine it's a challenge as well, but you have the entire musical world at your fingertips. That has to be a great opportunity, I think.
It is. And, you know, I have to mention one of the pillar pieces that we're presenting, that actually the piece represents community, but it also needs a community, is the Benjamin Britten's War Requiem that we're featuring in November. And this is significant because it is the centenary of the end of World War One on November 11th, which is the date of our concert, on Veterans Day. And this piece is a spectacle, but it's also a very, very reflective piece. It is the War Requiem, which is really a mass for the dead. And it's significant also because poetry is incorporated in this piece. Benjamin Britten, the British composer, incorporates poems by a World War One soldier named Wilfred Owen, and his poetry is embedded in the mass, in the Latin Mass for the Dead. But why I say it needs a community? Well, because you will see practically 200 people performing for the audience. We have a chamber orchestra. We have a full orchestra. We have the fantastic Fresno Master Chorale. We have a children's chorus, which features the Alta Sierra Intermediate School Chamber Choir, led by Gail Barber. And of course, Anna Hamry will be conducting the Fresno Master Chorale. And we have three soloists as well. We have a soprano, Selena Schaefer, a tenor, Vale Rideout, and a fantastic baritone, Christopher Nomura. So that will be an incredible, incredible spectacle, and something definitely for everyone to come out and see. It's a piece that requires many, many forces, but it also requires a community to really appreciate the piece.
Well, it's going to be a very interesting year, and I know we'll be talking more about these concerts individually as they come up here in the Valley. We have the Pops series starting September 22nd with a superhero soundtrack, and then the Masterworks series begins with the Grand Promenade, which you mentioned earlier, with the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 1 and Pictures at an Exhibition by Mussorgsky, and that original piece by John Carigliano. That's coming up October 21st. Before we go, Ray, and send you off, as I know it's a very busy day, what has your summer been like? Any highlights out there as you've traveled around the world?
Oh, my goodness. It's been so exciting. I feel like I've been in a different city every week. But, you know, it's been great. We've been hiking and spending some time, quality time with my family. But I also had to send off my son to college this week. So it was a sad parting. But I'm excited for him to start his new adventure as well. So it's been a really restful summer. It's been very hot, as you probably know. But it's been great.
Well, congratulations to your family and best of luck to your son. And we're very excited to see this new season of the Fresno Philharmonic take the stage of the William Saroyan Theater in Fresno. And congratulations for the honors given to you by the League of Women Voters of Fresno. The annual Women's Equality Day event is taking place Monday, August 27th at the Central Valley Community Foundation at Palm Avenue in North Fresno. Ray Hototo will make remarks there, and there will also be a performance by a string quartet. You can contact the league at 559-472-3018 for more information. And again, Ray, congratulations for those honors, and we look forward to seeing you back here in our studios in the near future.
Sounds great. Thank you, Joe.
And that's all for Valley Edition. As always, find our podcast and send your comments to us at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein, Monica Velez, and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.